Hey, friends. Quick note about this morning. We're going to do something a little different. At the end, when I'm done talking, we're going to do a bit of question and response relating to today's text or something I said or whatever. So there's a QR code. And also on your little, what do you guys call those? The piece of paper? Sermon notes, that thing. There's the QR code there as well. We also, so while I'm speaking, if I miss something, if I say something blatantly heretical, or you just have a question about the text that you're like, I wish we'd talk about this, please send one in at any point during the sermon. Please feel free to be on your phone, do that. Also, we do have another high-tech layer that we're adding in. If you don't feel like using the QR code, you can like put your hand up at the end, and we can use that too. It's a new technology that we're trying to introduce in 2024. So, one of the phrases that I often try to remind myself of, I say this because it's easy to forget, is this phrase, it's not all about me. And I try to remind myself of that because naturally and inherently, I don't want to believe that, and I don't want to live my life like that. And I'm constantly reminded of that now that I have children, that they believe the whole universe circles around their desire for a candy or like the thing they feel like doing or not doing in their preferences. But as a full-fledged millennial, I mean, that's baked into me culturally. Like, I've been taught to be very individualized and to think that my experience and what I want and my desires are king and that the world should kind of orbit around that. It's not all about me. That is a very deeply scriptural, Jesus-y type of mantra. It's not all about me, that everything in me wants to reject every single day because I want it to be all about me. As we look at today's text, I think what we're going to see is a text that opposes this idea of kind of this individualism or this me-centric way of thinking where Jesus is saying, it's really not all about me as the individual. Matthew 5, 38 to 42. I'm going to read it and then we'll dive in together. Jesus says, "You have heard that it was said, eye for eye and tooth for tooth. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. Give to the one who asks you, and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you." There is so much in there. There's an 8-week sermon series in this short little passage. Fortunately, I've condensed it into 3 hours for this morning, so wish you a reason. You've heard that it was said, eye for eye and tooth for tooth. When Jesus opens up with this, this idea of eye for eye and tooth for tooth is not actually just unique to Jesus or the Bible. This is in ancient Rome, this is called the Lex Talionis. You don't have to remember that, but the Lex Talionis is this idea of eye for eye and tooth for tooth. Babylonian culture, Roman culture, Jewish culture all had this idea of eye for eye and tooth for tooth. You've heard that it was said eye for eye and tooth for tooth. I think often when we read that with like kind of a vindictive angle, like, oh, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, like that's, you're getting back at the person or whatever. Jesus is referencing Deuteronomy 19, and this idea can be found throughout the Old Testament law as well. But what's actually going on here is, I think, kind of two things. Jesus is reminding the people of how just of a God God is, but also equity in justice. We don't talk a lot about the justice of God because it doesn't like sound that nice and all that, but it's actually a really good quality about God. Like we all love to talk about Jesus's grace and his compassion and his love. We all love to be just like, oh, everyone gets forgiven and all that. Until one day you die and you go to be with Jesus and your neighbor is like Hitler or someone like that. And then you're like, ah, no, actually that justice thing would have been a good thing, right? You know, it's like we like that the God of the Bible, it's a good thing that he opposes the wickedness and the evil in the world. We just often struggle with the language around that. So you read through scripture, you find a God who cares deeply about the oppressed. He cares deeply about challenging the wickedness and the selfishness and the evil of the world. He's a very just God. This idea of eye for eye and tooth for tooth actually is, in the Bible, is God saying, when you practice justice, when you practice judgment, do it in a way that's equivalent to the crime. Because most of us, when someone wrongs us, we like to think, oh, they took an eye? Well, I'll take two eyes. You know, it's kind of justice plus one. You know, like they slapped me, I'll slap them twice. They sued me for $2,000, I'll sue them for $5,000. They stole my cow, I'll steal two cows. They stole my dog, I'll steal their cat. You know, that type of thing, where it's always this kind of vindictive nature of us to like go further. And this is actually a limitation that the Bible puts on justice, where God says, no, like an eye for an eye, it's equal. A tooth for a tooth, a foot for a foot, equal justice. God is in the business of justice, and he's recognizing that his people, we are very aware of like, oh, how much that hurt me. And so we want to go justice plus one. We want to go further. So the Old Testament teaching is God is a just God, and let's make sure justice is equivalent. Then Jesus takes this a step further. In verse 39 says, but I tell you, do not resist an evil person. Do not resist an evil person. This language of resist is really about like opposing, like standing up, going toe-to-toe with an evil person. There's a lot of tension in this idea because we should actually be going toe-to-toe with the injustice in the world. We should be standing up against oppressors in this world. I think what Jesus is talking about here, and I think a lot of scholars and commentators, well, I don't think I've read them, that would agree that Jesus is more talking on a personal level. Like, yeah, like you see injustice, you see oppression in the world, we should stand up for that. But when it comes to like our own personal experience, when someone wrongs us, we should be less inclined to go and fight against that, and sometimes to just let it happen, to let things go by us. This isn't like arguing to like be in abusive, toxic relationships, but to be less concerned. Most of us are more concerned about the injustice that happens to us than what happens in the world. And most of us are part of some kind of unfair trade. Like we did that prayer, right? It was like hypocrisy. It's like, you know, it says like we're deeply troubled by the injustices in the world, yet we commit injustices ourselves, right? And so Jesus is saying, be less of a like, oh, but, you know, they wronged me type thing, and be more concerned about the injustice in the world. Don't feel like you need to fight everybody that commits unjust acts against you. Jesus was wronged all the time. When he's standing in front of Pilate, like on his like death trial, he just stands there silently. He just, all right. He doesn't argue. He doesn't fight. He doesn't just punch Pilate in the face. He could do all kinds of miracles, and he just, imagine getting punched by Jesus. Man, that'd be crazy. But anyways, he's just quiet. Yet when other people were treated unjustly, he was much more vocal. It was when other people were treated unjustly. We all have been wronged in life. We all are going to be wronged in life. We're all going to have people treat us wrongly. And so what I want to do over the next like the next few verses, I actually like to just write like, you know those blogs that are like, you know, like 7 habits of highly effective people, or like 6 ways to like sleep better, or 5 ways to make your nice long hair look voluptuous and brilliant, or 8 ways to not bore people to death during a sermon. It's my recent browser history, but those like 7 ways. I want to talk about 4 ways to respond when being wrong based on the text that Jesus is doing. And so we'll just kind of write this blog together this morning. So we'll look at these 4 ideas, 4 ways to respond when being wrong, because all of us, maybe today, maybe tomorrow, soon, someone is going to wrong you, someone's going to treat you unjustly, someone's going to be unkind, someone's going to say something about you that's untrue, someone is going to do something unkind to you. You're also going to do that to others. But this is going to happen, so Jesus gives us 4 ways to respond when being wrong. So he starts with this. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. My first time preaching on this text was during COVID. I was like, oh, if someone slaps you on the right cheek, they probably get fined and go to jail in like 2020 during COVID. But now we're kind of allowed to touch people again and stuff like that. So if someone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. Maybe you know this or maybe you don't know this, but when Jesus talks about the right cheek, there's actually a reason why he talks about being slapped on the right cheek. In Jesus' day, the assumption was that basically everybody was right-handed. Nowadays, most people are still right-handed. You know, we have some of those defectors who are using the other hand, but most people still are right-handed. Actually, I constantly wish I was left-handed. This has nothing to do with the sermon, so you can clock out here for a second if you want. But I was just at this middle school retreat, and they had a dodgeball tournament, and they let leaders go on some of the teams, but the leaders had to throw with their opposite hand. And I was like, man, I wish I was a left-handed person, because lefties have that superpower of being ambidextrous because the world has forced them into it. Anyways, in Jesus' day, almost everyone was right-handed. Here's the assumption. So when Jesus says, when someone slaps you on the right cheek, what he's actually talking about is a backhanded slap. He's not talking about a front-handed slap, because that would land on I'm saying the words wrong, but anyways, he's talking about a backhanded slap. Sorry, I'm like thinking about this in a mirror. It's a backhanded slap. And so this is important, because in Jesus's day, you actually were allowed, like especially as the man of the house, you were allowed to slap your wife. I'm not saying it's good, but you were allowed to slap your children. You were allowed to slap your workers in a disciplinary way. A front-handed, open-handed slap was an acceptable way to treat someone who was out of line and who needed some discipline and some punishment. This has sounded weird for a long time, especially in 2024, where it's like, you know, but that was actually, like, culturally, people would see that as like a normal thing. However, a backhanded slap was different. This wasn't disciplinary. This wasn't like, you know, Josh comes up and he's said something really bad, or he did a terrible job of leading music. I give him an open-handed slap. It's like, hey, do better next week type thing. I'm never going to do that. But if I got Josh up here after maybe, you know, things didn't go well in the set or something like that, and I backhand him across the face, especially in Jesus' culture, people would see that as a very demeaning, degrading thing. Now, I'm not endorsing that people used to be able to slap people across the face and all that. But what Jesus is talking about is not something that's like disciplinary, or not something that's like maybe utilitarian to like move forward and stuff. He's actually talking about a demeaning, degrading, like abuse. Like you're being abused, you're being made to look bad in front of others. This is being truly wronged by someone in authority over you. And Jesus says to turn the other cheek. Well, why? Well, because you could assume that if someone slaps you across the face, either in that moment or at some point, that person who's abused you like this, there's probably another slap coming. That's probably not the last time it's going to happen. Again, not an endorsement to stay in like some abusive relationship or whatever. One of the things we can assume about someone who hurts people, we probably all know people who like have a habit of hurting people or being insulting or unkind or hurting people. One thing we know about them, as bad as their actions are, is that there's probably something deeply broken and wounded within them. You know, I think about this sometimes when, you know, you hear about like an egregious crime or a shooting or whatever. I mean, it's awful, but I do often think, man, like, what's gone wrong in that person's life or experience? Like, what's so broken that that happens? And we should stand up to that kind of brokenness in the world. Jesus says when something comes along and someone hurts you, rather than our first instinct to be to think about ourselves and be like, oh, like I need to get this person back, to think, what's broken there? What's hurting so badly in that person's world? That old phrase, hurt people, hurt people. If you've seen I won't go into it. That's maybe not appropriate. But hurt people, hurt people. And it's like, this is the idea. If someone is hurting you or wronging you or insulting you, there's probably something broken and messed up in their situation. So way one of responding when being wronged by others is to extend grace. Grace. It's a simple word we talk about in the Bible. It's grace. When someone hurts you, when someone wrongs you, rather than first jumping to our own experience, to empathetically and out of grace think about, well, what's going on in their experience. It doesn't excuse the behavior, but a lot of times it gives us perspective to actually say, how could I invest in that person? They've already slapped me, but how could I invest in that person so that perhaps they won't slap the next person? Perhaps there'll be a bit less slapping. Slap is obviously a metaphor for wronging or hurting one another. Way number two, Jesus says, and if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. Some of your translations might say like tunic and garment and stuff like that. But here Jesus says, if someone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. It's a really interesting, different scenario, right? Because in the first one, like someone coming and backhanding you and demeaning you and hurting you or like insulting you or whatever is like, you know, abuse or unfair treatment or whatever. If someone's suing you and they could actually win and get your shirt, well, arguably, you've probably actually maybe done something wrong. Like you you know, maybe the justice system is that flawed, but like if someone can sue you and get something from you, you probably actually are part of the fault there as well. And this is kind of one of the interesting things about conflict in relationships. When we talk about being wronged, it's so often that we speak very categorically. It's just like they're wrong or that person's wrong. That person wronged me or this person wronged me. In most conflict situations I've experienced or I've watched others experience or I've walked through with people, it's that more often than not, two parties at least are involved. And maybe it's even 95% one person's fault and only 5%. Sometimes it's 90-10, 80-20, 50-50, whatever. Usually in conflict and broken relationships, there's like at least some degree of like a mutual kind of responsibility in it. Jesus' second example is an example where maybe the person suing the person is being unfair, but also maybe you have something that you're a little bit culpable for as well. In ancient Roman culture, when you took someone to court, you could sue them for this inner garment, their shirt. But you actually weren't allowed to sue them for their coat. That wasn't like a, that was never on the table. No matter how bad it was never on the table as something that you could do. Any of you guys, like, you don't have to admit, please don't put your hand up because maybe you're embarrassed, but anybody, like, ever watch those Judge Judy clips? She's hilarious. You guys know Judge Judy? She's hilarious. And we watch it, and what happens is we often side with one person, like, oh, I like that person. And you, like, pick the person you like more. Like, I hope they're, even if it seems like they're wrong. And we just wait for that moment where Judge Judy just, like, winds up and just pops off on the one person. She just, like, goes to town, rails on them, screams at them as though, like, that's kind of a judge's job, or it is on TV, but in real life, it's probably not helpful. And goes, and then there's like this like fee or this judgment extracted from the person imposed. And we love it when the person we're cheering for wins. And we're always the person that we're cheering for. However, Jesus would say, even in a moment where maybe you've done something wrong and someone's holding you accountable, or maybe you're not even that wrong, or whatever the balance is, they're allowed to sue you for your shirt, this under, like this undergarment. He says, why not just be like, here, you can have my coat as well. It's a pretty like demeaning and like hard thing for us to admit wrong, right? My wife has taught me a lot about this, leading into conversations and recognizing that conflict isn't just always that black and white, like it's 100% them and 0% me. And has taught me so much about when I go into conflict or go into a difficult situation, just looking for the spaces, even if it's small, even if with me it's usually small. I've usually done very little to be responsible for the conflict. It's almost always the other person. Hopefully you can relate. But looking for that 3%, that 5%, that 20, maybe 80%, all the spaces. It's harder when it's less. When you've totally messed up, it's pretty easy to find. But looking for that and leading with, how can I lead by owning my stuff? How can I say, you know what? I recognize, like, this wasn't the best. How can I do that? And that takes a lot of humility. And that's what I'd say is way too to respond when being wrong, is to offer and extend humility, to operate out of humility and recognize I'm not perfect. It's not all about me. I'm not flawless. As much as this person might be hurting me, this might be, person might be wronging me, I'm not totally perfect in this situation. So Jesus says, if they sue you for $1,000, why not just give them $2,000? As a gift. If they take your shirt, why not say, you know what, here's my coat as well. Being radically humble and saying, you know what, I'm not, I guess in the sense where, you know, Jesus talks about eye for eye. If you take someone's eye out, they can take your eye out. Maybe saying, you know what, I'm really sorry I messed up. Let me go an extra step and offer a gift. Let me, out of humility, do that. So we can respond in humility. Jesus continues on. He says, if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. So when Jesus was speaking, the Jewish people, the nation of Israel, they had been occupied by a few different nations. They'd kind of been passed around. It was kind of like game of hot potato, but big empires passing the Israelite nation around. And so there were, you know, Israel was wiped out by Assyria, but then Babylon came in and they kind of took over and imperialized the southern kingdom, Judah, which we call Israel now. And then they got passed over to the Persians. And eventually, when we wake up in the New Testament, they're owned by the Romans and they're imperialized by the Romans. And in that context, this idea of going 1 mile with someone, we're kind of like, what does that mean? In that context, there were levels of citizens, there were levels of people. And Romans were always above Jewish people in that culture. because, I mean, the Romans were the ones that owned the place, so they got to decide that. And so what a Roman could do is they could go up to a Jewish person and say, hey, I'm going this way. Could you please carry my bags for me? But they're only allowed to get them to go 1 mile. They could only ask them for 1 mile. So imagine this. You're walking west, and in a time where you have to walk places, which just takes forever, you're walking west. A Roman citizen comes up to you and says, hey, I'm going east, and I don't feel like carrying my bag anymore. Could you carry it for 1 mile? That sucks. That's horrible. Like, that is like, you're like, but I'm late. I'm trying to get, you know. It's like, no, take my bag for me. And you'd have to say yes. So you walk 1 mile the opposite way, and then you'd have to walk 1 mile back just to be at the point you started at. That's awful. Like, how could you imagine in 2024 Vancouver, where we're so concerned about time? And like, could you imagine? You're just like, oh my goodness, I just walk a couple extra miles. That's a really oppressive thing. So we've looked at a situation of like abuse and demeaning, and we've looked at this idea of like, you know, where maybe you have some culpability and someone's suing you, but then there's this like totally oppressive idea. It's like, this is not fair at all. All I did was be born to a certain family, and now whenever a Roman citizen comes up and says, carry my bag for 1 mile, you guys ever like, you carry your suitcase to the airport, you're like, this isn't bad. After like 10 minutes, you're like, this is bad, you know? It's like, they didn't have the nice wheelie, you know, all that. They didn't have nice airport luggage carts. You have to go 1 mile, even if it was the direction you're going. And what does Jesus say? Does he say, like, all his friends were hoping that the Messiah would come and he'd like zap the Romans, it would be fair again and all that. And he says, why don't you just walk 2 miles? Some commentators think, or scholars think, that actually what Jesus is saying about going the extra mile is actually tripling it, like going another mile and then an extra mile on top of it. So you'd actually walk like 3 miles. Most of us in 2024 Vancouver were like, walking 3 miles? I've never heard of such a thing. You know, if it's 1 mile away, I got an Uber, you know? It's like going, but even if it's just 2 miles, going that extra mile, carrying their bag, and it's not just carrying a bag. It's not like you walked up to someone like, hey, you know, I'd love to help you out. It's someone just coming and demanding that of you because of who you are, because of the family you were born to. And Jesus, rather than saying, stand up, punch them, fight them, say no, oppose them, he says, why not just do this? I'd say, because way three in the kingdom that we respond when being wronged is servanthood. We serve. The idea, I think, that if a Roman citizen would ask you to carry their bag for 1 mile, and after 1 mile you stop carrying their bag, the idea is, what's going to happen next? They're probably going to find someone else and say, now you carry my bag. Now you walk. Now you journey. Now you carry the burden. So if you were to do that, so if you stop at 1 mile, you would recognize that someone else is going to have to be inconvenienced by that. But if you say, I'll go an extra mile or another 2 miles or however many, is that, that means that someone else isn't going to have to do that. That person doesn't know you're serving them. Jesus doesn't say, well, while you're walking the extra mile, like put on a t-shirt that says like extra mile club and be like, hey, I'm carrying this. No one else is going to have to do this. Like announce it, let everyone know. But to just two things, to silently serve someone who doesn't know that you're serving them, and also to be able to look the oppressor in the face with eyes of servanthood, to speak to that brokenness and that arrogance in their life, and to just look at them the way Jesus does out of love and say, yeah, I'd be happy to serve you. I think about this often when I go get a piece of bread out of the bag, and I think we all do this. Right at the start of the bread bag, they put that garbage piece, right, that no one wants. And so most of us, we reach in, and we kind of slightly inconvenience ourselves to get a piece of bread that isn't the end piece. If we're honest, most of us even skip the second piece because it's still not that great. You know, we get to the middle and we get that out. But what that does is eventually means that the bag has two pieces left. So that all of us are hoping that the timing works out perfectly, that our spouse or one of our family members or someone else is going to show up when that happens. But really what that's saying is, like, well, I want the good piece, and hopefully someone else will end up with the bad piece. It's like taking the good parking spot, or when you're at the pizza party and you go first and you get the cheesiest, biggest piece of pizza. The choices that we make, the ways that, like, servanthood isn't just like signing up for a volunteer task and doing it once in a while. Servanthood is recognizing that the ways that I act, the things that I do, ultimately impact and affect other people. Me doing something, taking on a task, relieves someone else of having to do that. Or me taking the good thing for myself prevents someone else from having the good thing for themselves. This happens in churches a lot. We're like, hey, serve at Pilgrim Kids, or like, you know, be generous and support the church and blah, blah, blah. But we are often like, well, I think someone else will do it if I just hold out for a while. But the opposite mentality would be, what if I do it so that someone else doesn't have to do it? Or what if I do it first so that it impacts other people through the ways that I serve? Jesus wraps up like this. He says, give to the one who asks you and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. Give to the one who asks you and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. Jesus' early audience was probably mostly poor. So this was like, honestly, probably not the hardest part of this teaching for them. This is probably the easiest. In 2024 Vancouver, most of us aren't getting slapped. Most of us don't have like some nation making us carry their bags. Like lots of those things aren't happening to us. But in 2024 Vancouver, we're the richest people that have ever lived on the planet in the history of humankind. Even the poorest in this room, we're some of the richest people. So the idea of giving to those who ask of us and not turning away from those who want to borrow is a crazy ask, because we have so much and we're still struggling, right? It's like we have so much. There's that tension, I think, a lot of times when, you know, we talk about, you know, should you give money to the person on the street who asks for money because, like, what will they spend it on? And I think there's conversation to be had about, like, the wise ways to, like, give your money and when you give it and stuff like that. But I think a lot of times we just use those, I know I have, as an excuse or, like, an easy way out of having to be radically generous, right? Like, it's like, well, they might spend it on this, so I better just keep my money and I'll spend it on something else that I don't actually really need that much. You know, we have a lot of these ways of like justifying and convincing ourselves away from radical generosity. I'd say the fourth way to respond when being wronged is generosity. To go that extra mile and just say, how can I be incredibly radically generous? Jesus gave his life on the cross very generously, even to those who were oppressing him and sinning against him and hurting him. And it is very difficult for us to respond in that way. To just be wildly, wildly generous. We feel like our stuff is our own. I actually just saw this reel this morning where there's this pastor on stage, and probably judging on his suit and some of the words he's saying, probably a prosperity preacher who I wouldn't like some of this, but he did say something interesting. He said, someone in the room, give me the keys to a nice car, and someone right away just chucks them to him. He's like, I want a couple of people to give me $100 right now. And some people just like come up right away. And he said, do you know why they gave it to me so quickly? And people are like, why? And he's like, because I actually gave those things to them before the service and told them to do it. He's like, it was very easy for them to give it to me because it's mine and they knew it wasn't ours. And that's one of the unfortunate mentalities that we have in 2024 Vancouver, is we think that everything we have is ours and we're so rich and we have so much. But God says, like, I gave you everything. I just let you be born in this time and have given you the opportunity to be wildly and radically generous. In the first three examples, it's someone who's like abusive, someone who's like suing you. Maybe you're kind of responsible, but it's an unfortunate kind of like litigating situation. The next one is oppressors. Like these are all places of authority and position over you. In Jesus's honor shame culture, this would be an important distinction. These are all people who have power and authority over you. This last example is someone who's coming under you as like a beggar, someone who in Jesus's culture would be looked at with shame. This is a poor person begging on the side of the road. And Jesus is saying, whether it's someone who has authority and honor above you or shame and is kind of lower than you, what does it look like to be people who just offer grace, who offer humility, who offer servanthood and offer generosity when people are wronging us? It is wrong for someone to just expect our hard-earned money, right? Like it's not fair. It's like we worked for it. Well, some of us, I mean, maybe you like got inherited, but like most of us, we worked for our money. We did something to earn it, and someone who just wants it. It's not right. It's not fair. It's not any of that stuff. And Jesus would say, so what? You have an opportunity to be generous. Don't turn them away. Be wildly generous. It's probably like safer one day when you meet Jesus to be like, I erred on the side of generosity rather than the side of caution, being like, well, what would they spend it on? Where would the money go? I think you kind of try to balance wisdom in there. I want to end by, we're going to hop into some questions right away. If you haven't sent one in, feel free to send one in. But I want to close by reading this passage in 1 Corinthians 6. In 1 Corinthians, there are a lot of issues going on in the church. In 1 Corinthians 6, Paul opens by talking about people taking each other to court and stuff like that. A lot of times nowadays, people have used that passage to be like, Christians should never go to court. I don't think that's the best use of the passage. But Paul is talking about like conflict and infighting within the church, and he's all about promoting love and unity within the church, which only happens when we're willing to allow people to be wrong or to mess up or to hurt us and respond to them generously and kindly. But this is, I love what he says in verse 7. He says, the very fact that you have lawsuits among you means that you have been completely defeated already. Imagine like a preacher comes into your church. And maybe he's the guy that like planted your church a long time ago, but he comes into your church. He's like, you've already been defeated. You've already lost. You've already messed up. Like, that's what he says to your church. I'd be like, oh man, who's this guy? Like, let's get a different guest next week. But he says, you've already been completely defeated because you have lawsuits amongst you, because you're fighting against you. And this line, and this is so hard. Why not rather be wronged? Why not rather be cheated? What Paul is saying is it better to be cheated and wronged a bit, or to be people who are fighting to get our own and fighting for like our own personal equity and to try to like push people down who are pushing us down? I think Paul is saying, you know what? Turn the other cheek. Go the extra mile. Give them the shirt off your back and be generous. It'd be better to be wronged a bit as followers of Jesus in the same way that Jesus was wronged, rather than to be people who are fighting each other in court, who are trying to slap people back, who are trying to fight for the shirt off of someone else's back and turning away those who are in need. Anyways, I'd love to hop into some questions. Charmaine, have we had any come in? If not, we can sit in silent meditation for a little bit. So how can we follow Jesus' message and not be a pushover? That's a great question. I feel like when I talk about a passage like this, that's like the work I have to do is be like, hey, like I'm saying this, but don't be in like an abusive relationship. And like, I think that's, hopefully that goes without saying. This is why we call it question and response. I don't know how to fully answer that. But, and I think said something just a little bit like this, but I think like one day you're going to stand face to face with Jesus. And he talks about that sheep and goats thing, you know, it's like how you treated people is how you treated me. And if you haven't read that, it's in Matthew 25. But I think in that moment, if we're like really trying to be judicious with like going between like being generous, being gracious, and on the other side is like maybe being like not a pushover, my guess is that I'll hopefully feel a little bit better if I erred on the side of generosity and grace and all that. I think this is probably one of the reasons Christian community exists, is because we can navigate that hopefully in an honest way that's not just like, okay, how do I feel comfortable and have boundaries that make myself feel good? But hopefully in your home church, you can say, hey guys, like I've been trying to be really generous. I've been trying to be gracious, been trying to serve, been trying to be humble. However, I do feel in this relationship or in this situation, maybe this person is like taking advantage and it's actually not healthy for them. It's pretty hard to be objective of that on your own, but hopefully like a healthy home church or some wise people around you would help you really navigate that. So I would always say like having some good sounding boards of people that you trust. By people that you trust, I mean people who are wise, but will also tell you like it is. Who the type of person who'd say, I actually think you're not being generous enough. You're not being gracious enough, or you could work on this. You need some people like that in your life. So yeah, I don't know. This isn't a great answer, but having some wise people around you, but I would always just err on the side of like generosity, not to the point like where like you're enabling abuse or like, you know, inappropriate behavior from someone, but just being the type of person who's like, you know what, that person said something unkind. I don't have to like fight for my rights to feel better about myself. I don't have to do that. But always asking yourself, you know, what is the impact on the other person? How can I? Because showing grace to someone who slapped you isn't just like letting them get off the hook, but it's hopefully looking to what's broken in their life that you could say, how could I actually help with that? Slapping them back probably isn't it, but maybe there's something that we could like do for them. So I don't know. Tonight when I'm laying in bed, I'll think of a better answer and I'll be like, ah, oh, shoot, I should have said that. Let's do like one or two more and then we'll hop into communion. How could, should this text be interpreted for self-defense principles or unjust wars? I don't know why I chose this week for question and response. This is could have been better weeks. Like, if we're talking, I'm assuming the self-defense means, like, life or death. This is probably Fu, who does, like, Brazilian jiu-jitsu, and he's like, I've been training for this moment. I don't think there's anything in the Bible that says, like, we shouldn't, like, defend life. I think Jesus is more talking about, like, interpersonal conflict in general. Like, none of these, like, someone is dying. Like, he's more saying, like, how do you respond when someone is unjust to you? Because we're all going to be unjust to each other. When it comes to, like, someone breaks into your house, like, those extremes, someone's punching you, someone's, like, trying to, like, hurt, like, physically harm you or harm others around you, I think it's fine to do everything we could to resist them and to try to stop that. I think the eye for eye thing would say, you know, someone attacks you on the street and you can subdue them, that's great. But we've all seen in movies where then, like, they go the extra mile because that person hurt their family and they, like, take it out and kill them or something like that. Like, that's probably the distinction there. Wars, oh my goodness, I hate war because people are dying, but I also hate it because, man, it's just so, like, controversial too. Like, you know, you growing up, you learn about, like, World War I and II, and it's just so, like, the way we learn about in school, it's so clear. It's like, oh, they were bad, they were good. Nowadays, it's like, man, I've got, like, good friends who are so far extreme on the two sides of this, like, Israel-Palestine thing, and I'm like, man, I just, like, it feels really overwhelming. That being said, I don't think God likes it when people made in his image are being killed and being hurt and being harmed. So if there's ever space for us as followers of Jesus to figure out ways that we can be helpful in that, I would be useless, I think, going into a war because I am just like, I don't know. I'm just built different, but not in a positive way, probably in a negative way than people who do that. But I think there is space for that, so... Yeah, let's try one more question and see if I can come up with a better response. If not, then we'll just call it a day. So, how can the responses be modified in cases of abuse, especially pertaining to children who are often innocent and helpless? Yeah, for sure. So when Jesus says, this is great, I think I can do a little bit better of a job of this one. So when Jesus, thanks for this question too, whoever asked it. When Jesus says, don't resist an evil person, again, I think what he's really getting at is, in your own experience, if someone does something that's not like, that's like livable, insulting, inconvenient, just unfair, don't make it about yourself. It's not all about me. Someone's like hurting and harming your children and impacting the development of them, do everything you can to like stop that. You know, again, people threw all kinds of false accusations against Jesus and he stood there and took it silently. People were accusing sinners around him who actually were sinners. They were actually right, like the person was wrong. And Jesus stood up, Jesus opposed them, and he stood up for the vulnerable. And we should always do that as followers of Jesus. We should be willing to be the ones who like stand in the way, like kind of take the bullet type thing, who stand in the way and stand up for the vulnerable. My hope, I'm not saying I'm like good at what I'm teaching about this morning, but my hope is that you could probably say a lot of unfair things about me or to me, and I would kind of just be like, whatever. But if you did that to my children or to someone else's children, or actually even just to someone else that I feel maybe couldn't stand up for themselves, I hope I would speak up and stand up and say, no, like, that's not working. Actually, I was, it was not too long ago. This is a random story. My kids were in the McDonald's play place, which, gosh, there are so many fewer play places now. I had kids at the wrong time. This is my biggest beef with COVID, is that, like, play places. Anyways, they're in the play place, and I walk in. There are lots of kids, and it's so crazy loud in there. I don't know if you've been in one lately. When there are seven kids in there, it's just, like, this shrill scream. I walk in, and there's this other dad there, and he doesn't, like, look in that good of a mood, but he, actually, I have two quick stories. I'll share them. And I walk in, and he looks at me, and he just says, like, oh, those F and S words, bunch of F and S words in there, right? Sorry, I'm like censoring, but like he like literally dropped in some expletives about his kids and kind of inadvertently my kids too, bunch of, and said it in a pretty negative way. And he was like looking at me because after you speak, someone's supposed to respond. And I was just like, if he said that to me, like if he's like, ah, you're an F and whatever, I'd just be like, okay, cool, I am, whatever, I don't, that's fine. But he said about his kids and about my kids and the other kids in there, he doesn't know. And I just was like, I didn't get angry, but I was just like, yeah, I'm not quite sure that's like how I would refer to my children or other children. And then he's like, well, I don't care how you'd refer to your... I was like, well, you asked me. Like, I don't know, it's weird. I was actually also, we were in Kamloops a bit ago, and we were at this outdoor playground, and I was in the bathroom, I was in the stall, and beside me, I heard this dad come in with his son, and the dad was fuming. Apparently, the kid had had an accident. He's like, look what you did. And he's like, dropping F-bombs at his kid. And sorry that, like, all my examples have, like, expletives in them, but he's dropping F-bombs at his kid. He's like, this is stupid. You ruined your mom's day and stuff like that. And I sat there for a second, because I'm like, this... I actually can't even see them. I was like, this isn't like my thing. But I was like, this kid, I'm assuming is like 6 or 7 or 8, 9, like doesn't have a voice to stand up against that. So eventually from my stall, it's like, hey man, like, I'm sorry. I just can't sit here and not say something. He's like, shut up, mind your own business. And I just said to the kid, I was like, kid, like, you're not stupid. You're valuable, whatever. And I'm not saying this story to be like, I did something, like, if, you know, I probably could have done something better, but I do think it's like we should never stand by and watch vulnerable people who don't have a voice or the agency to stand up for themselves. As followers of Jesus, we should be actively involved in that. So, yeah, don't, hopefully that was helpful. Don't let your kids get hurt by people. That's unnecessary. While also teaching your kids that when someone says something unkind to them on the playground, they don't need to be vindictive and get back, but they need to figure out how to be generous, humble people who are just like, you know what, I'll let that roll off my back. So anyways, we're going to hop into communion. Jesus was incredible at standing up for the oppressed, yet allowing people to wrong him. Imagine this, you heal some lady's dead kid. You heal some blind people. You heal some lepers who were not part of society, now have their lives back. You perform all these miracles. You feed all these people. And then you're standing on trial. And while you're on trial, you've got these Jewish leaders who go through the crowd and they go to that lady whose kid was dead and you brought the kid back to life and is like, whispers some lie about you. And the lady whose kid you brought back to life decides to believe that. And it's like, oh yeah, crucify him. Go to the people who you fed who were hungry, the 5,000, and whisper some lies and they decide to believe that and they start shouting, crucify him. Goes to that guy who couldn't walk and just murmurs some lie about you and he starts shouting, crucify him. Like, these are people saying crucify him that literally couldn't even have been there before because they were lepers. They couldn't walk. They were dead. And just turn people against Jesus so unjustly in this trial that's a total sham. And Jesus just stands there silently. And he has this idea, it's like maybe it's better to just be wronged or cheated in order to be generous, in order to be humble, in order to serve, in order to offer grace for people. And that's what we get to focus in at our time of communion.